Bauer was still invited to a Princeton.
He had as a visiting faculty member
the partner in the Italian Milanese architectural firm of BBPR. I love to say the name Bianchi, Belgioso, Perasuti, and Rogers. And the Rogers in question is the uncle of the English Rogers, who is decking London with high-tech structures. But BBPR was very interesting in the early post-war in the 1950s, doing quite radical modern architecture, but frequently within the context of historic buildings. And then there was Mr. Scarpa, and the Italians seemed to relish the bare, you can't say bones, but this, the bare carcass of their medieval and Renaissance buildings, and loved to outfit them with very high-tech glass, lighting, exhibits, etc. In a kind of, again, dialogue between the old and the new. And our guy at Princeton was Perasuti, the P of BPPR. While here, he did a rather wonderful showroom for the Olivetti Typewriter Company on Fifth Avenue. Speaking of preservation, there was a modern interior that should have been preserved. It was quite radical and quite wonderful and quite sensuous, with great stands for the Olivetti typewriters rising in marble, sculptural basins for the typewriters, including one out on the street that the passing pedestrian could type on. I mean, something which was inconceivable today with vandalism and whatever. But it was a striking expressionist store, and of course was destroyed. It had a very short life, a very rich but short life. Minions and rooms in the front for Jan Rowan and myself. And it was in these rooms and the conference room way at the rear that we held the meetings to create Agbany and to start the whole organization to picket and make noise about the demolition of Pennsylvania Station. We had first become aware, we meaning the eventual group of Agbany, we had first become aware of the railroad's plans through the general information in the New York Times and other publications. And we were inspired to band together and take some action by a young woman at the time, Diana Kirsch, who, as I remember, was a South African by birth, and she'd gone to the University, I think, of Witwatersrand, and also, interestingly enough, with a partner of Denise Scott Brown, not a partner, a classmate of Denise Scott Brown, who eventually married Robert Venturi, and is a name in her own right in modern architecture. Diana Kirsch, at the time, was employed by Herbert Oppenheimer, and if I remember, she was the designer who did a bank at the north end of Times Square, where there now is a really sleek, later modern building, but it was a two-story bank, and it, sort of in the Mises style, she did it within the office of Herb Oppenheimer, and Herb Oppenheimer, of course, is still around, and you can ask him about it, but I think it was then called... Oh dear, Oppenheimer, Brady, and somebody. I think it's now Oppenheimer and Vogelstein, but in those days it was Oppenheimer, Larrakey, and Brady, or Oppenheimer, Brady, and Larrakey. I didn't know Diana, but she knew others, and probably Jordan Grusin and Peter Sampson. Elliot Bolinsky was also involved. He later became my partner, of course, in doing the original AI Guide to New York City. And one of the key people who moved away afterwards was Jim Burns, who had been on the staff of Jan Rowan's Progressive Architecture. And it was he who invented the Agbany Action Group for Better Architecture in New York. And it was a name that the New York State Education Department didn't like, because when we applied to become a non-profit educational institution, they said you can't use the word action because that implies you're a lobbying organization. So the actual papers, when they were made, said A Group for Better Architecture in New York. But there was a document, there was a charter, the list of the people involved were on it, and that piece of paper has apparently been lost. It was for a while in the hands of Elliot Berlinski. Unfortunately, Elliot died in 1990, and before that he had looked for it, as I remember, and he couldn't find it. But if the state of New York issues a charter, there must be some record of it in the coffers of the Education Department, and one might find it there. One of the reasons that I became chairman at the beginning was the fact that I was older than most of the really active members of the group. The people who were running around and doing the legwork were people like Jordan and Peter and Diana and so forth. And at that time, in 1962, how old was I? I was born in 26, and I must have been 36 years old. And some of them were, you know, 24. Or whatever. And the other is my Charles de Gaulle syndrome, in that people tend to elect tall people to be chairman somehow. They can overlook, if not physically, if not in other ways. But my duties as chairman was really to be a spokesman and a person who tried to organize special events that might support the activities of Agbany. I should say that from almost the beginning, we were receiving the moral and to some extent financial support of the Kaplan Fund. Ray Rubenow, who was executive director of the Kaplan Fund, was very interested in our project, in a kind of moral crusade for architects, and introduced us, particularly me, to Jack Kaplan, who was the man who gave the money for the fund. And Jack was an interesting guy. I mean, he is... He succeeded in his family history by his daughter and son, daughter Joan Davidson, Joan Kaplan Davidson, who was at one point chairman of the New York State Council on the Arts, and his son Richard Kaplan, who is an architect and is interested in many good works. I think at the present time, Richard is chairman of the Kaplan Fund. Going back to initial reactions of why we did what we did, why we were concerned, is the fact that some of us have been trained in a... By the way, that's the town bell of my village of Rock, R-O-Q-U-E-S, tolling the 6 o'clock hour, 6 p.m., and I'm sitting out on my garden, yes, overlooking the landscape up to the Pyrenees. And I can't see as many buildings in the distance, although I can see a great distance, probably 20 miles. I can't see as many buildings as there are on one block in Brooklyn Heights. Brooklyn Heights, where I lived before I first moved to Connecticut after I retired, and then to France. I think there was some confusion with Philip Oppenheimer. Philip Johnson was speaking on behalf of our group, but not Ada Louise Huxtable. It was Irene Lochheim, L-O-U-C-H-H-E-I-M, who had become by then Irene Saarinen. Irene was an art critic for the New York Times, and when she married Ella Saarinen, she reoriented herself toward architecture. And this, of course, was after Saarinen's death. Did I say Hero or Helio? It's the son, Hero. But at the time of the actual picketing of Penn Station, we organized a press conference across the street in what was then either the Hotel Pennsylvania or Hotel Statler or whatever of its many names it had at that time in August of 1962. We had the two mentioned. We had Philip Johnson and Irene Saarinen, and also John Johansson, and perhaps somebody else, but those are the three that I remember. And we had organized them and briefed them to speak on our behalf to the press, and which they did. And at the time, I think they were certainly on radio, if not on television. I did not own a television in 1962, but it comes back to me now. There must have been a television reportage of some sort, because I can remember going to Jordan Bruzen's apartment, because he had one, had a television, and looking at something, whether it was the actual picketing we were watching or part of the press conference. I just can't remember. But later on, to get some real intellectual meat into the conversation, John Rowan, who knew all of the big names in architecture, gathered together a group of them. I borrowed the Century Association, the Century Club, conference room upstairs. My father had been a member, and I persuaded someone to rent us the room, in effect. And we had the deans of a group of architectural schools. I remember we certainly had Sirk from Harvard, I remember, among others. Gosh, what's the name of the guy from the University of Pennsylvania who was there for years? I'll think of it in a while. And several others. Frankly, I just don't have a list of those people, but they were the sort of the heavyweight names. I think other editors of other magazines were there. I think that at the time there was still an architectural forum, and the editor of that was
Peter Blake. And Peter Blake, interestingly enough, Peter Blake was a person born in Germany and gravitated eventually to the United States and became editor of an architectural magazine. In the same way that Jan Rowan, my partner, came from Poland and eventually became editor of one of the other architectural magazines, Progressive Architecture.
It's a bit as if Jan was the incarnation of Joseph Conrad, the novelist who actually wrote in English, but he was Polish. And here were two Europeans who came and ran the English language architectural magazines in New York. Going back to the original question, you were a practicing architect. Can you talk a little about your work in this period? I had done two big houses in Tenafly, New Jersey, one of which had been published in Progressive Architecture. And it was the Seiden House in Tenafly. It was the first significant opportunity I had to publish a house. Not that I did a lot of houses thereafter, but the Forum under Peter Beck had also published my country club in Rivervale, New Jersey. I think that, however, come to think of it, the Rivervale Country Club, Edgewood Country Club, was perhaps a year or two before that. The Architectural Forum article about the Country Club was in an issue about young architects, and I suppose young architects at that time was considered to be somebody perhaps under 40 years old. Agbany wasn't actually a membership organization. It was a kind of consensual group of people. Anybody who wanted to be on board was on board. It wasn't a matter of contributing money necessarily, and of course we got some seed money from the Kaplan Fund, as I mentioned before, through Ray Rubinow, who was executive director of the Kaplan Fund. I think I'm very bad at remembering all the names involved actively with Agbany. I've mentioned Jim Burns, who I haven't seen probably in almost 40 years, and he went to California. and had another life there. But there was Norman Jaffe, who tragically drowned in a swimming accident a few years ago off Long Island. He was a prolific designer of rather upscale modern houses. Charlie Hughes at the time was doing, I think, if it registers correctly, some buildings, a sports building perhaps, for Riverdale, for the Horace Mann campus, would that be correct, in Riverdale? Excuse me. Elliot Walensky, I think, was still working for Max Urban, Max Hedda Urban. And Sandy Mulder was involved, Sanford Mulder, called Sandy. And many others. I think Philip Johnson got involved through John Rowan, who was editor of the magazine, would be in easy communications with him. You must remember this was 1962, that's 44 years ago this year. Johnson must have been then about 60. I remember he came to our office, my office, the office I shared with John Rowan at 33 East 61st Street, and was fascinated with the models I had been making for a house on Staten Island for what it turned out to be a mafia leg man. And the house was never built, but I did some interesting studies for him as well as the model, and this intrigued Johnson. Unfortunately, he never picked me up in the same way he picked up Peter Eisenman and Robert A.M. Stern and gave them a big push into the bigger time. But tant pis. And the way I knew he was a mafia guy was on our way back from Staten Island through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. He said, "How much do you want as a down payment?" And I said, $1,000. And he said, pulling a roll of money, just like a gangster movie, out of his pocket with a big rubber band around it. He said, take it from there. So he handed me the roll, and I peeled $1,000, I guess, and we went on our way. But the house never took off. It was on a great site near Wagner College on Staten Island, a great high ground overlooking the Narrows and the bridge. The early resolutions, if you can call them that, because they weren't engraved, of the group, were to continue this kind of activity with other threats to the architecture of the city. We thought it was very important to have the counterpoint of history, the counterpoint of expressed so beautifully at Penn Station between the steel and glass train shed, which was a very modern thing, in a sense. I mean, it was equivalent to the mid and late 19th century train sheds of Paris, which, by the way, Napoleon III called Les Palais Pluies de Paris, the umbrellas of Paris, which they were. But this was, in Penn Station's case, attached to a stone monument of grand space, the baths simulation of the space, that's not the function of the baths of Caracalla. And these two ideas, these two different spirits, gave great vitality to the experience of entering and going through experiencing Penn Station. As I remember, Aline Saarinen referred to it as the celebration of arrival. In reference to the possibility there were minutes of the meeting, the answer is no, not formally. If somebody took minutes, I don't know who it was. I don't know where they went. They went the same place that the charter we got from the New York State Education Department went, into somebody's box in somebody's attic, in a far-off place. Going back to your, again, comment about Agnew being, I'll rephrase that. You said in an interview in 1992 that you wanted Agnew to be the image of modern architects preserving something that wasn't modern. And I think that's what's at the root of it all, that up to that point, the almost the holy war of modern architects. That the fanaticism of some that just swept aside everything in their path was now to be balanced by the image of all of it working together in a continuum of historical context. And sadly enough, today, when you look at architectural magazines, most of what they're interested in are the star performers doing star building, freestanding situations unrelated to the cities they serve. We were very interested in the city itself as a living and growing organism, replacing itself, perhaps the way the cells in one's body replace themselves over the over your life. And that modern architecture should be modern and historic architecture should be preserved to maintain this continuum. I think this idea had a considerable impact with the architectural profession, but which has always been changing. We went from the École des Beaux-Arts of the 1930s and 40s to the modern architecture, at first largely imported from Europe, except for Frank Lloyd Wright, of the 40s and 50s. And in recent years we've had postmodern architecture, which is a kind of flailing about to bring back historic architecture without any real sense of the true history of it, and without a real bow to the needs of a more modern building. I mean, obviously, the classic example is a skyscraper. There were no skyscrapers in the Renaissance or in medieval times, so that it's a new form. And when you start making brand new skyscrapers in, let's say, neo-Gothic style, it's a little bit bizarre. Sorry about this coughing, cold, chest congestion. About the day of August 2nd, 1962, the organization of the press conference and distribution of information to the press was handled by Jim Burns, James T. Burns, Jr. And I can't remember any more about it than that. I was at the press conference where our spokespeople spoke, not involved in it directly, but just organizing the hardware and logistics, the tables, the chairs, the microphones, and et cetera. And with me at that time, there were others, but I don't remember who it was. It may have been Elliot Bransky. It may have been, well, certainly Jim Burns was there. Possibly Jan Rowan was there because he had the title of managing editor and later editor of Progressive Architecture. He had a certain status that main people recognized and would accede to his wishes to an extent. So he was a kind of go-between, Jan. Of course, he unfortunately is also dead. The foot soldiers had organized the previous week to prepare for the placards that were used that day in picketing Penn Station. They were on 20-by-30-inch, what used to call Bainbridge board, which were painted. They were done in my office. They were done in a conference room. We had great fun making up different kinds of slogans. Some of them, I think a couple of them, appear in the photograph that was in the New York Times, and perhaps they more appeared in other photographs. So we had a great stack of them. There must have been 6 or 8 people gathered in that conference room, painting them with tempera. Good God, I mean, I'm glad it didn't rain. Then we would have had a real messy situation of blurred ideas. We were terribly happy that Johnson himself came to picket and that he brought somebody of social prestige. I remember the name is Mrs. Parkinson, and I haven't looked it up in an old newspaper clipping, but as I remember, she was a member of the Board of Trustees of the Museum of Modern Art. And that was another kink in the resuscitation of historic New York as a serious project of modern architects. Agony was a little bit like the continuous floating crap game, the oldest continuous floating crap game in New York, in Guys and Dolls. It grew and lessened depending upon the date and what was going on. So people showed up with the crap game of the moment, and other architects were, architects are very jealous people, very jealous of each other's kudos and successes, great buildings. But when their buildings are recognized, they become very possessive of them. So that it's a group of independents who frequently clashed. There was some jealousy about who was handling this preservation angle, meaning we appeared that we were the rising phoenix, perhaps, and that from whose ashes. I don't know what the reaction was of the public on that day. The Times picked it up, and other magazines picked it up, but the general public, I think, was just not appalled, but just surprised. I mean, the fact that somebody, a group of people dressed in suits and ties and whatever, who are obviously middle class or more, were picketing Penn Station was something which was not in their knowledge and in their perceived view of history. And I think this, in the long run, was a great public boost for the Landmarks Commission. We'll talk about the Landmarks Commission later, but things move slowly, and the sacrifice of Pennsylvania Station on the altar of the future preservation, I think, is a fairly well-established fact, that the act of doing it wasn't done to preserve it, but when it was done, it caused the public to support the idea of a landmarks law. As I recall, the delegation to go meeting with Mayor Wagner, Fritz Woodbridge, Frederick Woodbridge is called Fritz Woodbridge. He was a architect between the two forces, after historicism and before great modernism, and Morris Ketchum, who was in the centers and things of that sort, very good. Fritz Woodbridge represented the AIA, you say? I don't really remember. I was a member at that point, and I think I was then or shortly after chairman of something called the Young Architects Committee, and Ketchum from the Municipal Arts Society. I became a member of the Municipal Arts Society fairly early. Actually, around 1955, so I've been a member of the Municipal Arts Society for more than 50 years, although they probably don't remember that. And the Municipal Arts Society at that time was giving awards for good work. It wasn't taking any particular stands on any subject, but of course neither was the AIA, it was as a group, equivocal. I remember appearing, and it wasn't on behalf of Penn Station, but it was on behalf of a later fight, which I'll talk about another time, the fight to prevent what was called the ABC plan, which involved tearing down a lot of buildings, including the Tweed Courthouse and the Equitable, the insurance company across the street, to make a giant new civic center, including a very tall office building. The ABC plan, because it was Abramovitz, Branis, and Cutler. Max Abramovitz from Harrison and Abramovitz, Sire Branis from Pomerantz and Branis, and Cutler, who was then the managing partner of Skid Mowings and Merrill. And we wanted to stop that because it was tearing down some good buildings. A lot of people didn't think highly of the Tweed Courthouse. It had great space, and it still does to this very day. And it was a kind of megalomaniacal plan. And I remember Cy Brannis in that instance referring to us as gadflies. I thought gadfly was a term of honor. And in any event, it was shot down. When we discussed it in an open meeting of the AIA, which was the largest meeting I think I'd ever seen at that time, we were in the old buildings on East 40th Street. There was a large dining room where you could take meals if you cared to. And in that dining room, we had the meetings of the general membership. And there was an almost passionate business of trying to get the New York chapter of the AIA to take a stand on that, on the situation with the ABC plan, and on anything. So earlier, in relation to Pennsylvania Station, we had great sympathy, but not the political force of the chapter. Not that the political force of the chapter would ever count for too much, because architects don't have much clout. It's the people with the money who hire architects who have the clout. In respect to the January 3rd, 1963 City Planning Commission hearing, as I recall it, I did appear and I did give testimony. And the grounds for the testimony was that in order to construct Pennsylvania Station, the city had given the Pennsylvania Railroad the bed of the street of 32nd Street, because the station is a two-block entity. And when the Pennsylvania Railroad could no longer afford to maintain itself and said it had to sell its station to a developer, which was the reason for tearing down Penn Station, ostensibly, we should give the railroad should give the street back to the city. And therefore, there was no two-block, would be no two-block entity in perpetuity. It was given for a function that was a service to the city and would be turned over to someone who was just making a commercial profit. I mean, the Felt brothers were at best devious. Hadn't remembered that the Lennox Commission had actually come into existence in April of 1962. Why do I think that it was really came into existence a couple of years later? And then I'm going to go look it up. But Jeffrey Platt, who was, as you say, the first chairman of the Landmarks Preservation Commission, personally regretted that his commission had come into being too late to try to save the terminal, but that was April, and the big thing that we were concerned with was not until August, so what the hell was he doing? I don't remember trying to influence him, or we just considered that the Landmarks Commission at the time was impotent, or that Platt was powerless, or didn't care, or whatever. I went and got a copy of the New York City, Guide to New York City Landmarks, forwarded by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. This particular copy was 1998. In the beginning, it was edited by Andrew, by Andrew Dolcott. And in the beginning, there's a statement. The Landmarks Preservation Commission created in 1965 in response to mounting public concern over the destruction of many of New York's historic buildings. The Landmarks Preservation Commission is responsible for blah, 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 blah. That's not 1962, it's 1965, and that's the way I remembered it, that it was at the end of the year of 1965, end of Robert Wagner's term. And the previous organization must have been a Landmarks Committee, not a Landmarks Commission, so that it would be something with little or no power. And then looking at your next paragraph and the possibility of conflict of interest again in relation to James Feld, who was chairman of the City Planning Commission, and whose brother, I think his brother was Irving Feld, who was, I believe, head of the organization creating the Madison Square Garden construction. I think it was a little bit like those people who said, well, Madison Square Garden will be another landmark. I mean, we're replacing the old with the new. But the problem was that the Madison Square Garden they built was a ninth-rate piece of architecture with no grand spaces except for the arena itself, but not for the passing public. It's a piece of junk, as far as I'm concerned. And it's going to get far lower in status in present landmarks arguments than the Huntington Country Museum, which at least had a relatively distinguished birth in the hands of Edward Rowell Stone, who was a wild romantic and just thought the girl was the be-all and end-all of his time in modern architecture. But again, I knew Ed Stone. He was a design critic of mine at graduate school, Princeton Graduate School. And thinking back on it, I even knew Frank Lloyd Wright. Frank Lloyd Wright was a great friend of Ed Stone's, and he had arranged for our class to meet Wright at a restaurant in Manhattan one time. There were seven of us in an advanced class, and Stone himself, and then Wright. This was at the time that Wright was building the 60 years of living architecture pavilion on Fifth Avenue on the side of the future Guggenheim Museum. And just an interesting passing, who you've seen and heard firsthand. But Stone, although he can be derided for being hopelessly sentimental perhaps, was a serious architect. He had built with Philip Goodwin, the basic box that was the original Museum of Modern Art on 53rd Street. Agony proper wasn't really involved in anything else. Some of the members of it were, and a lot of them were in the famous funeral march at Grand Army Plaza for the Savoy Plaza Hotel. The Percy Pine house was much later. No, wait a minute. The Percy Pine at the Bilko house that I'm thinking about is much later. And the Metropolitan Opera House, I wasn't even involved in from a distance with a 10-foot pole. But the remnants of Agony, Ray Rubenow tried to persuade us to form a more permanent organization. I mean, he had an idea that I should give up the practice of architecture, perhaps just teach and do this, do good architectural politics. And of course I didn't, but there was a reprise at the ABC plan that I've been speaking of before. And actually he and the Kaplan Fund gave us a little money to rent some offices that we could pursue a campaign to prevent the ABC plan from wiping out some buildings, and basically to prevent it from being done at all as a kind of megalomaniacal idea on the part of this self-appointed architectural committee. One thing that we did regret is that we weren't around at the time they demolished the Great Singer Building by Ernest Flagg, which was a magnificent building, with which I was familiar. The U.S. Steel Building is on the side of it now. And I had enjoyed an interview with the president of Singer at one point, and he had an office at the very top of that building in what could have been classified as a minor ballroom, a great, it was a kind of bulbous building at the top, and he was in part of the bulb. And he was a friend of my father's, and I can't remember his name. He was a lawyer who had been lawyer for the company. And then they made him president. And he didn't know anything about sewing machines, but he knew about business and law. And I can't remember it. But I remember being there and having these extraordinarily strong memories of that internal space, and then of the building itself, which is one of the tallest buildings in the world that has ever been dismantled and destroyed. I mean, the economics in that situation must have been staggering to take such a big building down to produce the U.S. Steel complex. Now, all of this led up for Elliot Belinsky and myself to the AIA Guide to New York City. And it was only in 1965, perhaps 2.5 years later, that we proposed to the New York chapter that we be allowed to write such a guide. There were others who made, I think, proposals at the same time, but we expressed our seriousness or showed our credentials, whatever they were, and we were allowed to make a sample guide to kind of illustrate what could be done. This was a 15-20 page leaflet, copies of which are very rare, and I still have one. And that was then used by the public relations man of the New York chapter. His name was Andrew Weil, W-E-I-L, to sell advertising, so that the original AIA guide was published like a magazine. I think it had 80 ads, was that possible? 80 ads at $1,000 a piece? Maybe that was it. And that funding, which was handled through the New York chapter, through the treasurer, Lathrop Douglas, our old employer, allowed us to not only buy film, rent cameras, pay subway fares, whatever, but also to hire a graphic designer, hire a printer, and actually produce 10,000 copies of the book. And it was presented for the 150th anniversary. It was 1967. It was the 100th anniversary of the New York chapter, AIA. The New York chapter having been founded as the first chapter of the national organization, which had been founded 10 years earlier, in 1857. So 1867 to 1967. And these were distributed free to people who attended the 1967 convention. Then after that, another edition was picked up by Max Urban, who had been our patron as president of the New York chapter. It was he who we had persuaded to allow us to do the guide. He was also president of the New York Board of Trade. I think that's the right title. And he bought some vast number of copies for them, which had a separate dust jacket on them. And then we paid for that. We paid for all these things by getting Macmillan to publish a trade edition 1 year later in 1968, which is the nominal first edition of the guide. And part of the royalties for that were not money, but I think there were 18,000 copies of the guide mailed to every member of the AIA in the United States. And that was the one that was blue. The original edition was brown, with black with brown lettering on the cover. That was a blue edition. And the only thing that Macmillan did, they picked up our work, our pay stubs in effect, and added an index. A simple index at that time. And then we went on in 1978 to a second edition, 1988 to a third edition, and then in 2000 I did a fourth edition. And we're now considering, well, more than considering, working on putting it on the internet, and at the moment we haven't decided whether it should be just free, the whole damn thing, with advertising supporting it, or it should be done some kind of a fee basis without advertising. But in any event, my hope is that it will be the whole guide. It will be interactive, that you can click on maps and get entries, or you can click on an architect's name and get his works, et cetera, et cetera. So it'll be, instead of an index of that sort, it'll be a graphic way of moving around the guide and getting close information. And then again, we hope to do another edition in 2010 of the printed book. And because I'm in France, and New York is there, and I'm not quite as young as I used to be, I would have somebody else take over the bulk of the work, and it would be a work by Mr. Smith, with White and Walensky lurking in the background. Somewhat intertwined with all these experiences, that's my relocation to Brooklyn. I bought a house with my parents, my mother's help, in 1965, on Pierpont Street in Brooklyn Heights. And there I was in what was the first landmarks district, in a sense. It was a national landmarks district, which had been arranged, in effect, by a group headed by Otis Pratt Pearsall, who is, of course, one of your board of directors. But there I was immersed in historic architecture over a fairly wide-ranging piece of history. I mean, there was, of course, a book about it at the time. There was Old Brooklyn Heights by Clay Lancaster, which had been, again, supported by the... financially, I don't know, but it was supported by Otis Pearsall. And that was just the buildings built prior to the Civil War. But all the buildings afterwards, there was a continuum of history. And to the credit of that community, the Brooklyn Heights Association and others supported the construction of the Jehovah's Witnesses residences on Columbia Heights in a modern style, as long as it was appropriate and fit into the context of the city. And therefore, the Ulrich Franzen building, which is there, was something which was not only accepted, but was promoted by the historicists of the community that already lived there. And some other modern architecture came in. I mean, it's a good example of a modest clearing, a modest extension of architectural history in a handsome Brazilian community. I mean, the buildings by Joe and Mary Mears on Willow Place, the three or four houses, are really quite delightful. And they've done similar things in other parts of Brooklyn as well. But introducing modern architecture into that scale was wonderful. We did not, when the Brooklyn Heights District was designated by the Landmarks Commission, be quick enough to include the block on which the present Pierpont Plaza building sits, which is really one of the great excrescences of Brooklyn. And there was a rather marvelous building there before, another Frank Furness building, Frank Furness being one of my favorite disappearing architects with disappearing architecture. I mean, he had a number of wonderful buildings which have been, by hook or crook, destroyed. Probably one of his best is the Bushwick Democratic Club on Bushwick Avenue, which had a more than suspicious fire which destroyed it. And, of course, this building, the Brooklyn Trust Company, I think it was, that was demolished on the site of 2 Pierpont Plaza. But scratch that name, bad memory. It's not Frank Furness, it's Frank Funen, a native Brooklyn architect. Frank Furness was a great Philadelphia architect of great exuberance. Probably even more exuberant, but Frank Freeman did a number of buildings in Brooklyn, including the Herman Bear House on Pierpont Street, the present St. Anne's School building, which was a men's club, built as a men's club, et cetera, et cetera, in many different styles. But he was, although he was eclectic, he did the eclecticism with great exuberance. the St. Anne School building was built as the Crescent Athletic Club. Continuing in my practice, I was interested in fitting contemporary serving buildings into the existing contracts, and I have, of course, two examples of that in Greenwich Village, one of which is on the site of the old Village Voice building at 7th Avenue South and Christopher Street. It's a 750-square-foot plot, and it makes the corner real again, which was, of course, destroyed when 7th Avenue South was cut through in the 1940s. So a whole series of buildings along there have fulfilled the geometry of the new 7th Avenue, but this was one of the contributors. And it is a building in a kind of strict Georgian style, perhaps distilled vernacular might be the appropriate term. The other building is on West 10th Street and Hudson, and is an apartment house, but it was done with a industrial vocabulary because that's the nature of Hudson Street. Always meaning that not only was I involved with the attempt to preserve distinguished historic buildings, but also attempted to fit modern facilities within the context of historic communities.